And do you know that a loose cannon?
Oh, is that the term
for when a cannon breaks free and starts just careening around the ship on the deck, and it, I guess it just murders people.
I bet. Welcome to Bald Move Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for Shogun on Hulu. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back to talk about episode 4, The Eightfold Fence. Aaron, how you feeling about this episode?
I continue to love this show. It's the bright point of my week, and it's always a little bittersweet when the credits roll, because I'm like, damn, I really want to know what happens next.
Sure, sure.
It's a real die is cast moment, right?
Oh, and yeah, yeah.
You wonder with the wheels within wheels, like, how much of everything is a scheme, how much of it is a plan. Is Toranaga suspecting that his impetuous son put in this position would do something like this? Does he secretly want it? Is he being put up to this by Omi and Yabashiga as a way to kind of like thread this difficult situation they're going through? And yeah, I this show is beautiful. It's extremely well written, extremely well acted. It's just so easy to watch. It's an hour show. It feels like it's 30 minutes. What did you think, Jim?
I'm kind of hoping this is Toranaga being put on his back foot a little bit, because I really appreciate when Toranaga is sort of driving the car of the plot, when he is the one making the moves. Although it kind of flies in the face of what his son was talking about and saying that he always says, right, which is let them make a mistake. He's actually making some moves here. So I kind of hope this is a surprise to him, because I don't want him to be clairvoyant. I don't want him to be such a mastermind that nothing can surprise him and he plans 19 steps ahead. Yeah. I want him to be kind of challenged with his strategy and have things come up that fluster him a little bit. But how he reacts to it is going to be the exciting part. And so I'm kind of hoping this is not all part of his plan, but we'll see. That said, I think the episode was surprisingly riveting for an episode that not a ton happens until the very end, right? Like seeing Toranaga go into Ajiro, is that the
Ajiro,
city that
the fishing village,
the village I guess that Yabushige's nephew kind of rules over, having him go in there and just sort of claim the loyalty of Yabushige's army, I thought was awesome. I really enjoyed seeing that, and just like seeing Yabushige's reaction to it, because boy, that flusters him. He's just like, oh, I thought I had control. This guy actually has control.
Right.
That's great stuff. A lot of good Blackthorn stuff in this episode. I have questions around some of that we'll get to during the podcast proper, but yeah, man, I really like this episode. I'm really settling into this show.
There's some, you know, it's not often. There's a show occasionally where I'm like, oh, you know, I got to go through the motions of looking like stuff I don't really care about. But this is like the opposite, man. I get about 5 hours to do my note taking because I always watch it for pleasure. Like the evening comes out and then I settle in to do my big note taking research. And I'm finding I'm using all that 4 or 5 hours, man. I can just like continue to go and like, what is this Japanese phrase? What is this thing? What is this food? What is this? You know, what was the historical context of like canonry in, you know, Portuguese and Dutch and English versus Japanese? And I just like go through these rabbit holes. And I just find it extremely fascinating. And it feels like it's everything that I find out is like rewarding to me. You know, there's nothing. It's like, oh, and I feel like there's other evidence, you know, because I'm I think the official subreddit's doing a really good job of allowing book readers adding extra context without allowing them to actually spoil things. And a lot of the changes that they're making seems to be to fix some of the ahistorical things. Like we talked about this a little bit, but this is the big reveal, is that, you know, in the original Shogun novel by Clavell, the essential thing was like the Englishman bringing the magic boomsticks to Japan, you know. Whereas this is rightfully pointing out that Japanese have been familiar with rifles for several generations and have integrated them into their, and they're not impressed. Like, you show us how to clean and shoot a rifle, fuck you.
Yeah.
But it does appear that there was some discrepancy between the canonry that the Portuguese were at least comfortable giving to the Japanese versus what the, you know, the this English-funded Dutch ship has got in terms of the technology and the accuracy. And that I just thought all that stuff was riveting, you know, the idea of what these cannons can do to the accuracy of them and what they can do to flesh. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I couldn't tell if that was, it looked like that was the chain shot that they were using, which
is either chain or maybe even canister or what they call grape shot, which is essentially just a giant shotgun, but it just mulched those guys, man.
Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty shocking, I gotta say. It's by far the goriest thing I've seen this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I keep comparing this to Game of Thrones because obviously it's the obvious comparison. It just felt like one of those things where a well-meaning and bright young nobleman's son, you know, like something that Robb Stark would do, you know. You cheer him and you think, oh, man, his heart's in the right place. But, geez, is this really the right thing to do? Your dad's doing this carefully folded origami plan. And then you just go and kill Ishido's envoy.
And he's goaded into it is the thing. That's the part that's like, oh, yeah, this is really just not the right move to make here. There's no way Toranaga would have done this.
And I think the show's also clever because, like, showing, like, Blackthorn's obvious deception and how he is his manners and behaving in that last episode, I think is supposed to inform us of Yabushiga's actions. Like, his, you know, like, that's not how Yabushiga normally acts. Oh, my God, what are you doing? This is a crazy provocation. No, my lord, don't. Like, this is not the, so, like, I think you're supposed to understand that he's putting on a bit of a show hoping to get the result that he gets.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he directly sent his nephew in there to kind of convince Toranaga's son to do what he does, but if he didn't, I mean, he certainly would have.
Yo, I think that's what I'm starting to, and there's so many things that are subtle that you can debate about whether it's actually what you saw. Because the show's very clever and delicate that way, but I'm starting to get the idea that Ami his nephew.
I don't know his name.
He might be the brains behind the operation. It seems like he is the one that's seeing the angles that his uncle doesn't quite see. Maybe because his head's not as high on the chopping block, so you know, there's nothing like impending disembowelment and decapitation to kind of, you know, make your vision kind of dim and pinpoint, but it seems like he's got. But also, I got some things I think are obvious to the show, but I'm saying that just because like that's my opinion. I got some opinions on the spy because I think they're setting.
Oh, me
it
too.
Seems like
yeah.
they're setting Aomi up to be both this very smart guy, but also very myopic about, you know, like what comes to women. Let's say. So yeah,
I can see
again.
It. Yeah.
What a great show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really captivating me.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move. Yeah, unless you got something to add, maybe we can just get right into recapping this episode.
Yeah, let's do it.
So we open with the scene of Yabushiga's nephew, Ami, receiving word that his village is once again playing host to his uncle, and he's joined by a special guest, their ultimate lord, Toranaga. The entire village springs into action to receive them.
This is much ado about not much with this note, this message that comes in, man. You got a stick and a box. And all you're carrying in that box is a piece of paper. I don't know. Seems like a lot. I mean, you could just tuck that into a fold of your robe or something.
I just thought it's interesting that, like, imagine someone coming to, like, a small town and being like, hey, the president of the United States is coming. Get ready.
Sure.
And, like, everyone in that town knows what their duty is to do. And they're just, like, all polishing and cleaning. And I was also gratified to see rolling out a literal red carpet. in...
Yeah, I was looking at how they're getting prepared, and it's a lot of sweeping of porches and entryways, uh-huh. and a lot of cleaning of fish guts off of walkways. And
sure, yeah.
You know, you're scrubbing that stuff down. Yeah. And then rolling out the red carpet and gathering on the coast to greet them.
Got to get all your men polished up and in their best armor. And throughout this whole scene, Omi's ambition is palpable. Like, you can just see that he's like, the contrast between his uncle's first visit and the second is pretty big. Like, he is now like looking forward to, yes, I can't wait. And then Toranaga too. Oh man, I'm going to turn this place out.
Yeah, I think that it helps that he impressed his uncle the first time around and got some acknowledgement for that.
Got a little bit of confidence.
Because he seemed very nervous that first time. He was like, oh no, is he here to replace me, or am I going to be chastised?
He's going to boil me?
Sure, boil me alive. Yeah, maybe that too.
Because that's the thing, is as much as I like Yabashiga, I always have to, because he's just like, I don't know, he's, I guess, the most relatable of the samurai, because he's a lot more American. Like, he's big show, outward show, like when he's depressed, he wears his three hearts on his sleeves, it seems.
Sure, he has what I would describe as a personality, whereas the rest of them are just kind of...
His eightfold fence is more of a threefold room divider. I enjoy that about him, but he also is fantastically cruel. He's like, he's like just a much more likable Bolton. You know, he's like a Bolton that doesn't have a stick up his ass or completely psychotic. Although he is kind of, I don't know, could be a cultural thing too. So we back up a bit and we're on Lord Toranaga's ship, entering to the Anjiro's harbor. And Fuji pleads with Mariko below decks to be spared the fate of being a barbarian's consort. And Yabashiga complains that Toranaga's actions have probably doomed them all.
Sure, but he's not very smart. Can you negotiate with the regent? Because the thing that happens here is Fuji says, I don't want to do this. And Mariko's like, well, you kind of need to do this. This is actually not as bad a fate as you're feeling like it is. And this is, you know, a continuation of what your husband would have wanted. And then she goes above deck and says, well, she won't do a year, but she'll do 6 months. I didn't think that was an option.
Yeah, and I really loved how Sonata played that reaction, where he just kind of rumbles. Like, and it to me is the manifestation of like, well, this is some bullshit because I'm her lord, but also
her husband and son just died. Maybe I'll cut her a little slack.
You can expect a lot from a Japanese princess, but they're going to eventually have the play, because she can always just take a sword and kill herself, you know? Maybe she dies in dishonor and shame, but. Mm-hmm. You know,
she doesn't have her family to live in that dishonor, so who cares?
Exactly. When her present becomes intolerable. So it's like, I thought that there was kind of, I actually like that acknowledgement that, like, Toranaga's, yes, he is absolute ruler, but like in every other instance of these feudal societies, there's also some unwritten, the lord has to kind of be fair to wield that power effectively. So
sure.
And also, I think the other thing is, it's like, in Toranaga's mind, maybe that's the other part, is that Toranaga's mind, he only needed 6 months because he needs this barbarian to teach, you know, and that was kind of the timetable he put forth. So when he asked for a year, that was maybe him asking for more than he needed. So when she countered exactly what he needed, he's like,
if not, I'm not sure what he needs a year for. If he thinks that Blackthorn is going to be useful beyond training this army, I don't know, but.
Yeah, and I think Mariko is also very powerful. Like, they keep on hinting like how powerful and important she is. But like, to the extent that like everyone like universally respects her, so I think Fuji, and there's the same where I'm getting like half of what's probably intended on the screen when Fuji kind of changes tactics and says, "How silly of me to prate on about my troubles when you've just lost your husband." I think that was her kind of like trying another angle to get Mariko to go to bat for her. Kind of like, you know, we're in this together, or we're, sympathy. You know, your lot in life sucks. My lot in life, can we all put our heads together and see how we can limit our shame and embarrassment and all that? So,
yeah, they're going to bring it up later. But are we supposed to know? Am I supposed to know that what Mariko's last name is or what her family name is? Or is this a secret that they've intentionally been trying to keep? That's going to be.
I think it's a secret
big.
Because, like, okay. Obviously you can look up the Tota last name, and but like they're definitely slow rolling this out, the revelations, gotcha. And I was okay. Like, it's a good move in terms of buttering Mariko up to be like, oh, you don't owe me any explanations, but I'm like, god damn it, Blackthorn, demand explanations. Yeah, demand explanations from this mysterious Japanese woman. I need to know.
Yep.
I also thought it was interesting how, because I don't think they've given the Toranaga's kid, Nagakato, much characterization other than, you know, Toranaga being a little bit disappointed and him not taking some of his father's like wisdom to heart. But they're also showing him that that he's kind of looked down upon by the other lords as this kind of spoiled, royal, soft-handed, no experience warrior baby. And he's got a chip on his shoulder about that. And he tries to assert his authority, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, they will get into that later with Omi.
Yeah. And I also just, man, Yabushiga, he is so ballsy dealing with Toranaga, where, you know, he's ranting about, like, I can't believe you resigned the thing that keeps us safe, and now you're defying mm-hmm. the lords, and then he gets all lost in his ransom. Oh, I'm sorry. You probably need to just kill yourself right now, right? Maybe I'm being insensitive. That's such a great line.
Yep.
Yeah.
God. That's the thing with Yabushige. It's he's a character I enjoy watching. Like, there's a distinction between thinking that somebody is a good person and someone I would like to know and hang out with in real life versus being entertained by watching their antics. And that's what he's bringing, is the antics. I love it.
He's just like, he's got this political race car that he's constantly keeping in the red, just seeing, like, how much can I get a couple more RPMs out of this? Oh, I better back off. And
It does make you wonder how he gets to a position like this. His father must have been somewhat important, and then he becomes somewhat important simply because of it, because nobody really likes him. Nobody is thinking, yes, this is a very smart guy. This is a guy that I want to hitch my wagon to.
Or what if he's just a fucking beast on the battlefield? One of the answers is, well, he's just little fingering his way, and like, this is how he got, like, he is just, mm-hmm. you know, not letting go of one branch until his grip on the other is secure, and just like he is deftly navigating. And but it seems like he's a pretty extreme samurai in terms of how he treats the Bushido code and how he comports himself. But maybe he's just an animal on the battlefield too. I don't know.
Could be.
Anyway, upon arrival in Enjiro here, they're met with hundreds of soldiers cheering them. Yabushige offers his men for inspection, and Toranaga pumps them up, low-key steals their loyalty, mm-hmm. and then ghosts back to his ship, leaving Yabu just completely dumbfounded
at what's happened. Man. The fact that he walks in, he says a few words with his fan, everybody starts chanting his name instead of Yabushige's, and then he gets on a boat and leaves.
It's almost filmed as comedy, right?
Oh,
like, you expect he's got this army and he's going to lead them. And then as you're thinking that and they're cheering, you see him just waving his fan as he's already on the boat halfway across the harbor back to his ship.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, yeah.
Just seeing Yabushige's reaction to it, he's so dismayed by this. Like you said, dumbfounded, right? He's like, how did the loyalty... like? Yes, they're always by proxy of me loyal to Toranaga, but they're loyal to me, and they chant my name, not his.
And I think the calculus here, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Shogun at baldmove.com if you think you know better, but I think the calculation here is, like, Toranaga knows what fragile position he is, leaving his son and his bargaining chip with this man whose loyalty he can't count on. So, and I also think that probably Yabushige could force these men into be loyal to him, but Toranaga just made it much harder because you know, like showing and waving the fan. Now it's like, if Yabushige acts disloyally around any of his men, they're going to be like, the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas making him publicly commit to Toranaga to everyone in a way he's never... And it gets hilarious in later in the episode where he's trying to both sides to their face.
Like when he meets with the messenger on the battlefield. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
I also love this villager, this woman who's, you know, bringing out the sake, yes. right? Like, and then when he doesn't even stay for a glass of sake, she's like, "Ah, I should have bought the cheap stuff."
Yeah. I should have got the better stuff. I don't know Toranaga is actually going to be here. And then, Jesus, he's gone. Get the shit stuff out. What's that say? I think it says something about Yabushiga too. That the villagers fear but don't respect him because they would serve him inferior sake.
I could see that.
And they're going to serve him inferior sake because.
Is this a sizable army at the time? I really don't know how to calibrate on this. It looks like several hundred warriors. I just don't know if that's a large force.
So I'm rolling with this the way I did with Game of Thrones, where I'm assuming that the balance of power is pretty finely divided amongst the lords, because the show's told me that as much. Like architected this to where they're all kind of roughly equal in power. Toranaga maybe has gotten more economic and political power in the intervening years, but like, so anytime they show me a large new force with a new weapon, I'm assuming that's going to be not a guarantee of a win, but probably a decisive advantage if it's used properly. So that's what I got.
I think the cannons definitely are. Like, Blackthorn's kind of the wild card here for him.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And not just the cannons. So like if Ashido's men get his hands on some fine muzzle-loaded bronze long 8-pounders, do they know how to use them? Do they know how to do the calculate the range and the elevation and do like this? Like, even if they get their hands on a technology, this training is going to be invaluable. So yeah, I think having a crack artillery team in a land that doesn't have artillery is probably going to be a pretty big advantage.
Yeah, I would think so.
Also, I love Blackthorn. Like, he's got enough Japanese to pass for polite, but he's also got his Portuguese to insult Omni direct. Uh-huh. You know, so only Makito, or Mariko rather, understands.
Yeah, and she's so, you know, proper that she doesn't want to relay his insults. That would be offensive and dishonorable. So yeah.
And you can see Omni's kind of, what's funny about it is Omni kind of is charmed by Blackthorn. It's like, oh, he's well, look at the barbarian all glowed up and cleaned up. And everyone kind of marvels at that old lady you're talking about. Is like, this is the barbarian that just left us a couple weeks ago. And I really like that. Yeah. I think the scene also shows like Toranaga's gift of inspiration, that, you know, he has this calculated show of respect to his lessers that is designed to like really, you know, like Yabushiga's never done anything like that. So the men feel this kind of, and the Yabushiga's also not super well liked, probably more feared, and like Toranaga's kind of stealing their heart.
Oh yeah.
I don't know which of the three hearts he's stolen, but
sure.
At least one of them. Blackthorn then tries to inquire about his men and ship because he's all anxious to get about what he's about. But he quickly finds out he's still a prisoner of sorts, and he fumes as he's introduced to his new house, his household staff, and his consort, the Lady Fuji.
Okay, this is the biggest question I have in this entire episode.
Interesting. Okay.
Why don't they respect the gardener? They say he's not to be called Sama.
I think Sama is like an honorific. I mean, this is seems like it's a class-based society, and this manual laborer, just you wouldn't say. You wouldn't disrespect him, but you also don't give him, you wouldn't call him sir. Like, Blackthorn essentially saluted and called him sir, and like, it even offended the gardener. He's like, nah, I don't know.
Sure.
You know, you're upsetting the social order, sir.
I didn't know if he was some kind of dishonorable person. Maybe he had committed some sins that were unforgivable, but he didn't kill himself because he's not a samurai, and like, he's just sort of an outcast who they allow to stay there and serve for them.
He could be some kind of like untouchable or undesirable caste, or he's committed some kind of crime. But my feeling is this is this royalty dealing with peasants, and now the barbarian by being the Haramato, is that the?
Oh, that's true.
He's now like a samurai lord in name. So she's trying to teach him like you gotta walk with a little bit more grace and
can't give so much respect to the underclasses.
Yeah. You don't thank the gardener uphill. for You don't thank the gardener for doing his, your job. He thanks you for giving him his bowl of rice.
Yeah. Interesting. So the other pirates are in Edo, right? That's the hometown of Toranaga.
I don't know if I believe that.
Okay, sure. I might not believe that either. That's what they say, though.
And what I mean by that is, like, I don't know that I believe that Mariko would tell Blackthorn the whole truth about anything. Like, mm-hmm. they might be dead. I kind of think that I'm like 50% they're dead, 25% they're safe but held in a place that they wouldn't tell Blackthorn about just as a precaution, and like 25% maybe they're just in Edo chilling.
Sure.
As political pawns. I don't know. So, and then the thing is, like, Blackthorn acts like an asshole here, but I guess it makes sense because he thought he was going to... Do you think he thought that he was going to just get his men and, like, maybe, like, backstab Toranaga and steal the ship? Or is he just myth that... Because I don't... If I was an Englishman shipwrecked on 17th century Japan, and, of course, I got my 21st century modern sensibilities and cultural understandings intact, I think that if Toranaga said, hey, I'm going to make you the samurai lord, and I want you to train my men for 6 months. In exchange, I'll give you your ship and your men and your weapons back. Mm-hmm. I don't think that day one of my regiment training, I'm going to get the reward and payment for my services. I would think that after I delivered a fully trained regiment, I might get my men and ship back. So I thought, like, this seemed a little foolish, but...
The thing I think is going through his head here is, and I kind of saw a little bit of this last episode when Toranaga made him the Hatamoto, and and he sort of started to reject it and then realized, oh, actually I need to do this. And I think what he was thinking is, there's somebody on this ship, one of my men might have some more experience with this kind of thing, and I can use that experience to impress Toranaga.
I don't know shit about field tactics, but maybe one of these Dutch guys,
that's what I'm thinking it was going through his head. So when he gets back here and he realizes, oh, my men aren't here, he's shitting his pants because now he has no idea what to do to train these men.
That's a good thought. I also wonder if it's like him trying to kind of test the limits of his power, like, I'm a samurai, like, I just want this boat, who's this guy to tell me that I can't have my boat? And he finds out, oh, it's not. Because he's seen instances where the Japanese deference and politeness has almost led to, like, political disaster. So he's like, maybe if I'm confident enough, I can just get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yabu, he's not the only one fuming, because Yabushiga is also pissed about the position he's been put in. But his nephew Omi, tries to see a winning angle. That's pretty much the scene.
It is the scene, and I do wonder if there's anything in this scene that we don't see, because I think the next time we see Omi, he's going to be in what's Toranaga's son's name? I don't know his name yet.
Nagakata. I know it's Naga, but I'm not sure if it's Kata or Kata.
I'm not sure if the next scene, well, the next time we see him,
Nagakata,
I guess, is with, is it Kiku? Is that who the consort is?
The courtesan.
And obviously there is some encouragement happening there, but I do wonder if there was any encouragement sort of reading between the lines in this scene, or maybe as a follow-on to this scene that we don't quite get to see, with Yabushige saying, hey, go to Omi and try and convince him to do something crazy.
I'll say not only that, but also I think Kiku might be the spy.
I'm almost
convinced. And I think if there's one criticism about this episode, I think they were one beat too heavy-handed with it. Like, this significant look she gives where she's playing the guitar in the corner was, like, already, like, radar up. But the next scene where she's, like, clearly trying to...
It's too much if they don't want us to know. So they clearly want us to know.
Yeah. But it felt, like, so obvious you might as well reveal it in some way. Like, have her get a letter. Like, have her show her sending a scroll and attaching it to a bird in the depths of night. Because she's a midnight bird, right? That would have been cool. But So, like I said, I was expecting the full third step reveal. So, and that's the Omni's plan is essentially because Yabu's like, yeah, I look fully committed here. Like, I can't do my both sides bullshit because I'm like, how can I just help the Lord escape? And now I'm training an army for him in his name. They're all shouting and you don't haven't got your spy. So I'm assuming Ishido is just getting all of this in real time. And Omni's like, hey, relax. We don't know what's going to happen to this regent thing. We get a lawful order to execute the Lord anytime. And look, you got a fully trained gun regiment with advanced weapons. And that's a nice bargaining chip for Lord Ishido, right? So that's what I'm saying. Omni feels like he's seeing all the angles here.
Yeah, he's seeing more angles than Yabushige. Because, I mean, what happens later, I think... I don't know. It's super interesting when we get to the actual canon stuff. Because this stuff's all going to come back into play. So maybe I'll save it for then.
So Blackthorn's still very frustrated and annoyed by his predicament, and Mariko tries to teach him the Japanese outlook on grief and introduces him the concept of the Eightfold Wall before gifting him his two pistols as a measure of trust and respect.
Eightfold Fence.
Eightfold Fence.
The title of the episode. Yeah.
Right, you're right.
This is some sort of disassociative meditation, I guess, that they do when things get pretty bad. They just sort of detach themselves from the present and their worries, and they just go about their duty, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, broadly speaking, on a society, as a society-wide kind of thing, that seems profoundly unhealthy. But then I didn't grow up in a land that could kill me with typhoons and tsunamis and earthquakes and
yeah.
You know, it's like, it's very hard. It's, yeah, you know, I don't want to engage in cultural relativism, but like, it is also hard to just the way that like that's the one of the things I was pondering is like, you know, a lot of world looks on at horror America and our culture of gun violence, right?
Sure.
That's something that we are even kind of moderate centrist type people are comfortable with, obviously, because the shit's still happening. And that's kind of crazy and weird, but we were shaped by our culture and our country and in a very particular way the rest of the world doesn't understand. I'm getting to understand that, like, this Japanese culture has been shaped by their cultural forces and the land and their neighbors and stuff. And they've got, you know, stuff that I find very hard to understand, things I find are profoundly unhealthy. But
yeah,
living
in the Midwest, it's you don't have a lot of the things that they deal with, right? If you're on the coasts, sure. The conditions are a lot
the
same.
Ghost of Bill Paxton is screaming about tornadoes right now.
It's really
we do
the
have
only
those.
Thing we have, though. Like,
yeah.
So the sky drops down on you every once in a while and sucks you up into oblivion. Big deal.
Yeah.
When the earth shakes, then give me a call because that shit's terrifying.
it has a much wider area of effect.
Yeah, it's the thing you count on to be stable, and when that is not stable, it's terrifying. It's a bad feeling, and then you know. It's not typhoons, but it's hurricanes, that kind of thing that happen on the coast.
But there's also a lot of, like, I guess this Eastern philosophy that I admire, the idea that, like, we really have so little control over our lives that a little bit of detachment and acceptance and, you know, acknowledgement, it's essentially alcoholic anonymous that, you know, I'm a small thing in this giant universe and I have very little control. I have very little agency over my own life. And I don't know, maybe that's a healthy way to deal with that too. So I liked about, like, you know, don't be fooled by our politeness and our rituals and our decorum, because beneath all that we could be thousands of miles away all alone. And she leaves him his pistols wrapped in silk as a gift.
Why does she get him his pistols here?
I think it's a little token of, like, peace. Like, you know, he's been kind of humiliated. The Lord made him this powerful samurai and then made him swim. And I do wish we knew what happened with that race. I do wish we knew the outcome of that race.
Right.
And then he got humiliated when he wanted to go see his boat, and he was, you know, he's feeling like a prisoner and he's had all this stuff put upon, and like her giving him his pistols, I think. It also might be a way of, like, her saying, like, hey, if Abigail gets too much and you're too frustrated, this is like your English seppuku. Do you think there's any of that?
Yeah, one to the gut, one to the head. One of those will kill you.
You shoot yourself in the gut, I'll stand behind you.
Yeah.
You know, as your second. So the next morning, they're preparing for their field exercises. But first, there's a dispute about whether Blackthorn can even wear these weapons among the samurai.
you know, sometimes it's nice to have someone who doesn't care if they live or die on your side. Like Fuji, because she does not value her life, seems like she could be a valuable ally.
Yeah. And the fact that she's a highborn lady of, I think, higher social rank than anyone in this village, except for maybe Abashiga.
Sure.
It's a great moment where, like, I thought it was great because I thought it was all being in theory. And Mariko's like, hey, you know, here's the solution. Give him to Fuji. And she's the one that came up with it, too. Give him to Fuji. That lets everyone save face. And also, no one will take him. She'll die before she lets that happen. And like 30 seconds later, she's like, I thought that was such a powerful scene. Because I was thinking, like, oh, man, what if they just like snatch this weapons from these lady? And she's like, no, fuck, be on your way, boy.
Yeah. It's interesting how she doesn't touch them with her skin, right? She has her kimono or whatever she's wearing there sort of between her and the guns.
The way you'd handle a katana, you know, you don't want to touch the oils.
Respect.
Yeah. And this obviously like raises the esteem that Blackthorn has for Fuji way up. And Mariko, too, I think was impressed by the way she just backs Omni the fuck off.
I assume not touching these guns is also symbolic of the fact that she doesn't own these. These aren't her guns. She's just holding on to them, and they are owned. They are the property of Blackthorn.
It could be. I decided that to me, it's like because I just recently watched the Kill Bill, and I saw so many similarities to the way that Hatori Hanzo. And his servant handled the weapons when they're not being used. Like it's all using the silk of your sleeves to present it and. So that's what I got. But yeah, also she's probably trying to be a little bit demure and respectful to her lord. So on the field, Blackthorn realizes as a sailor, he doesn't have shit to teach these soldiers about land warfare. And he does find one thing he does know about: naval cannonry and gunnery.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, so I was sweating right alongside him here when this scene first starts. I'm like, oh boy, here we go right into tactics. They already know how to load these weapons. They already know the rudimentary fundamentals here.
Which is them, but just so you know, that's also them correcting the historical inaccuracies of both the book and the original series, which just all is like, oh, you got boomsticks. Oh, we're just gonna win the war with gunpowder.
And then he has this idea, which I think is brilliant, potentially using the cannons to punch holes in the wall of Osaka Castle if they wanted to get their guys in. He's got a pretty destructive weapon here. And how much easier, what a breeze, what a walk in the park this must have been for him, firing and aiming these cannons on dry land. Yeah. Like, can you imagine how hard it is to do this when you're cresting 15-foot waves?
Yeah,
you and aiming time, at another moving vessel, like
you got to time the roll that you're on as well as the other ship on, and
so
yeah.
This is a breeze, man. He's not even breaking a sweat here aiming these cannons.
And I love how contemptuous Yabushiga and his men are of these cannons. Like they set it up within like essentially archery range, and when he's like, "Oh, move further," like this, but these cannons aren't that accurate. They're not going to do. I was actually interested, and I did a little research, and apparently, I guess this is fairly historically accurate, that the Portuguese had given the Japanese guns and cannons, but they were more of like the light kind of cannons that, like field pieces that are designed to be like kind of moved by men on the battlefield. They're lighter, they weren't as accurate. They're also, the difference between this also breech-loaded versus muzzle-loaded, I guess the Portuguese gave cannons which are breech-loaded, which means you load them at the rear. Mm-hmm. And the limitations of that design is there's only so much powder you can put in them, and also the breech closing mechanism can leak gas, so it's not doesn't transfer all the power powerful. Of the charge to the cannon. Yeah. Also, I guess those are smaller, lighter, and cast iron, and I think these are supposed to be brass, which I don't as much fucking sailing shit as I've read. I don't understand why brass cannons are better. I think it's something about they don't. Like under when they get hot, they don't expand and they don't droop as much, so they maintain your accuracy. But and the muzzle loading—that's you load the cannon from the front. You know, it's the familiar. Yeah. You put in the charge and you pack it down. You put in the wadding. You put in the shot, and that allows much more powder and allows a much more accurate and flatter trajectory, so you can be more accurate. And I guess that's what the Japanese didn't have. They didn't have access to the superior forms of like naval canon that are they're much more accurate. So
do you know how that works on a ship? Like when they when you fire, because these are the cannons off the ship, so they're muzzle loaded cannons on a ship. When you fire out of a ship with a muzzle loader, does it kick back the cannon?
Yes,
you know, in a Newtonian reaction.
Yep.
And there's some kind of catch that grabs it. Okay.
They have these they have a series of like what do they call that? Winches, not winches, they're pulleys. So all the cannon usually have two to four cables holding it to the deck, and it they back it away like 3 foot from the windows to load the cannon, and then the men winch the thing tight against the ship, and then they fire it, and that cannon just comes flying back against, and then it's right ready
to
be
what
reloaded.
I figured again. Would happen. That seems terrifying, but
oh yeah.
The breech loaders are probably just permanently mounted on the deck, right?
And do you know that a loose cannon?
Oh, is that the term
for when a cannon breaks free and starts just careening around the ship on the deck? Oh. And I guess it just murders people. Like this,
I bet
2,000-pound piece of iron just rolling around on wheels on this deck that's pitching and turning and
wet. Yeah.
And yeah, a lot of men, especially in fierce combat, would get injured because you know not everybody be clear. You didn't get all your hands and feet out of the way, and So I thought this was a really cool scene and a good way to alter the source material to add a little bit more historicity.
Yeah.
And Yabu's just, of course, delighted. He enjoys this the most. He's like laughing at the destruction that these cannons are causing.
I like how they set up multiple sort of layers of targets so that you can see it hit not just a single target, which would be fairly easy.
Yeah.
But it hits in a straight line. Like he can target multiple targets with the same cannon.
Yeah.
So it really is impressive.
Another thing is it's not just the technology, it's the training, you know.
Totally, yeah.
There's modern day, you could probably think of counterparts or like you can give a nation advanced weapons, but if they're not trained in using them and what kind of and they don't have the supplies necessary to maintain them, of what benefit? So like I like how they pointed out that he also has like the little I'm not sure what you call it, the sextant, the surveying tool that allows him to gauge the accuracy like very quickly and accurately to put that fire. So they're learning. It's again like even if Shido stole all these cannons, of what benefit would it be? Because he has no idea how to shoot them accurately.
Yeah.
So this goes so well that Blackthorn kind of lobbies Mariko about the merits of, you know, I could be better used if Toranaga would let me have my men in my ship and we could build him a navy, build him into a naval power. But she impresses upon him his need to understand the Japanese, I guess, fatalism, their view of life and death before he meddles in their politics.
Yeah, and she's, I think at the beginning of this scene, kind of reading through the journals from ship, the rudder or whatever. And then we get to the earthquake stuff, and I was kind of curious when they included the earthquake stuff, why do that? But it was interesting, I guess, that he had never experienced an earthquake. I go figure the pirate has never experienced, the guy who spends his life in the freedom of the sea has never experienced an earthquake.
Yeah,
makes sense. And then she uses this to sort of convey the Eightfold Fence philosophy a little bit deeper. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move.
Also interesting the contrast between, because like, you know, if you know anything about the Atlantic and Pacific, the Atlantic is this terrifying, capricious sea that storms whip up at any time, and you can have calm weather and then it's just a storm is on you. And the Pacific is named that because the sailors, when they finally got there, like, holy shit, this ocean's so much more easy to navigate, and there's winds are more predictable and the storms are, you know, with rare exception, are not as fierce. But over on the Atlantic side, they don't have the Ring of Fire. They don't have any idea of like earthquakes, or at least in England, they don't. Obviously, they would know about this in like Italy and other places, but just the contrast between the land and the sea, I thought was kind of interesting.
One other thing they have over there, volcanoes. We don't have any volcanoes here. Hawaii has one, but
Yellowstone. It's just been a couple hundred thousand years since it popped off.
Sure. Any day now.
any day now. But I thought that was cool. And then, like, the idea of like, not only are you experiencing an earthquake for the first time, but you've not even heard Like, yeah. Can you imagine? Because, like, you know, if I have earthquake happened, I was like, oh, this is, I haven't felt an earthquake before, but I know what's happening. But this is like the earth just starts moving under your feet. Wow.
Yeah. That's, like I said, terrifying. It's the kind of most dependable thing in any human being's life is that when I step on the ground, it's going to be firm under my feet.
Yeah. And then she kind of explains to how this has shaped the people, you know, that we're living this island country and we're very isolated and our houses are flimsy and easy to construct because they could get knocked down and set on fire or swept away by a tsunami. And we just kind of like have this, I'm not sure if it's like a fatalism thing or like a rational acceptance of death can come at any time. And that's definitely in contrast to his kind of like optimistic ambition where I'm just going to do my thing and I'm going to win, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I love how they take this like national sort of adaptation and then they make it very personal in the later scenes where he talks about the houses that can be torn down 50 times and rebuilt 50 times. And, you know, he doesn't see a destroyed house. He just sees the house.
Yeah.
Yeah. That stuff is really good.
And he's also trying to bring his war and kind of have common cause with their war. But there's a barrier here because Mariko is Christian and she doesn't want to believe the worst about those people.
Sure.
It's interesting to see that.
But they were Christians trying to kill them in the woods, right? I mean, that's...
No, they were trying to kill you, homeboy, not us. That's her. But you can see
she's
trying to...
Well, then they tried to kill Toranaga, so...
True. True. Yeah. Meanwhile, Ami, pillows with the Kiku, the village courtesan. She seems very interested in puffing him up and putting ideas into his head.
Yeah, this becomes pretty interesting here. Especially when he takes this idea to Toranaga's son and it becomes, you know, actionable here. I like that this is probably Ishido's influence, right? Like, Ishido is actually the one calling the shots here. If this is his spy, then she is planting ideas in his head. Like, if not just delusions of grandeur, then at least, like, goading him into trying to influence the situation.
Yeah, he's making Yabushigo's life more difficult. And she's pumping him from information. She knows there's cannons.
Yep.
He's helpfully supplying how good they are, you know, and what a powerful weapon they're going to be. And she's going to put that into her note to Ishido. So, if this guy kills his uncle, presumably to add a loyalty to Ishido, then that would work out for him. So,
sure.
What do you know? The next day, Shido's Inspector Josen rides up to demand. I keep calling him an inspector because that's what his role was in the first. I mean, he's probably just like the Iron Fist of Ishido, but his majordomo, whatever, rides up to demand Yabushiga return to Osaka and pledge loyalty and answer for his recent actions. We understand that answering for his actions in this case would be killing himself.
Yes. Yeah. He'll be asked to do that. And the resolution here is that Yabushige is able to talk himself sort of into a little bit more time, and then the ability to demonstrate these cannons. And that, to me, I never want to count Yabushige out as far as being a adept strategist, because he's sending a warning to Ishido. He's buying a little bit of favor here by demonstrating, getting this guy to stay and look at these cannons, and then Ishido will know what he's up against.
Yeah.
It's not just
cost.
Hey, impress them, and it's revealing information intentionally here.
Yeah. And he's also got because I'm just following orders, you know, like this is the Council of Regents, they are the rulers, but I do feel like this is the most desperate he looks because, like, especially when they're close enough, they can hear him, both things he's saying, where he's like, hey, look, man, I'm going to betray, you know, Ishido's his best chance to win. And he goes to Toranaga's son. It's like, I betray your father? Just the thought of it would seem crazy. And and then say the funniest part is when he says his son is like, oh, we're going to show him a demonstration of your father's power. And it's going to make the lords in Osaka tremble. And Josen's like, I look forward to trembling tomorrow morning. It's just this ain't fooling nobody, right?
I mean, it might strike a little bit of fear into them, but more importantly, it gives it the element of surprise, which is more valuable.
Yes, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he complains.
Ooh, that guy.
He complains to his nephew about, I'm in such a bad position, but he sees another solution that we'll come to understand here in a bit.
Oh my god, his description of the cannons at the beginning of this scene. Cannons to enough to shrivel Christian balls.
So good. Maybe we should, because maybe we know too much, but we talked about chain shot, round shot, grape shot. Maybe you can explain to the listeners the difference in these rounds, or if you appreciate.
I think
that.
I understand a round shot is just your cartoon cannonball, right?
Yep.
A round sphere that gets fired out of the barrel and hits something directly.
It's good for blowing holes in ship hulls. It's good for blowing holes in ship walls.
Sure.
And it does terrifying damage on the ground for infantry, because that thing, have you ever seen any Revolutionary War, those things are bouncing and it can just shoot a corridor through a thing of troops.
The chain shot kind of seems scarier to me because it has a more wide dispersal. The way I understand it is chain shot is two of those cannonballs connected by a chain, and both of them are shot out of the cannon simultaneously. And they just sort of chaotically whip around with the chain holding them together. And whatever they hit is just bisected by this chain.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird that they were using this in land purposes, because I've always understood a chain shot is used as more of a tactical, like you're wanting to cut the rigging of a ship.
Hit a mast, yeah.
And like, you know, cut the lines so the mast will fall and you can disable a ship. Because they have a dedicated anti-personal round, which is...
Oh, that grape shot kind of thing.
Yeah.
It has another name, you said?
I think it's canister shot, because it's essentially a cardboard tube of golf ball-sized iron balls. And there's like 50 to 100. And just imagine a shotgun that's like 12 foot long. And what that could do to troops at like 100, 200, 300 yards. It's going to just mulch anything in like a 10-yard radius. And they're terrifying. Terrifying.
Yeah.
So that night, Mariko explains the tense political situation of Blackthorn, which causes him to exchange gifts of weaponry with Fuji.
Yeah, wow. This gift from Fuji, I view definitely as more valuable. It has more meaning. I don't think the Blackthorn puts a lot of personal meaning on his guns. It's more like, my guns are my defense, my guns are my weapon. But like, this is, the swords are wrapped up with honor, with family legacy, with all kinds of stuff. So,
yeah,
I think he appreciates that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think he likes his pistols. Like, maybe I would like my favorite pistol, but then I also have my grandfather's 20-gauge birding gun that he got when he was 13, and has been handed down to my father and now me, and I'll hand it to, like, that's different, you know? Like, that's
sure,
a different.
Sure.
And this is like, yeah, these family swords. And we saw in the previous episode how much meaning these have to her. What they mean to her family in terms of, like, that's the living embodiment of her family's honor on the battlefield. This scene is like, I feel like we're going to, in retrospect, see this as a kind of the pivot of Blackthorn's Japanification, like Fuji's taking him seriously. It's like, hey, if you're going to be the samurai, you need to carry some weapon. To not shame me, not shame you. He's trying to natto, which I would say as a Westerner looks and sounds disgusting.
Sure.
It's fermented soybeans and the texture and like stringy, gooey Limburger cheese.
Yep.
It's a strong taste, but he's acquiring it.
Bad smell too. This is definitely like a big turning point for him. And he, not just in like the actions he's taking, but his desire to see it as something important, I think is changing, right? Before, I think he's always been kind of bewildered by these customs and by the culture. Now it feels like he's wanting to understand and really get into this Japanese lifestyle.
And maybe sees the value of them, you know?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, he's starting to come around.
And there he's also like throughout this episode, you see him continuing to learn Japanese and, you know, learning the tenses and the grammar and the structure and all that stuff. And he tries to thank Fuji in her native tongue and he kind of gets it wrong. But she, you can start to see that she's appreciating the effort and sees that he's getting there, you know, that she kind of sees maybe some of the value that he has as well.
Absolutely. I mean, the way she starts out this scene, I'd sooner pull a gourd from a horse, which is an amazing expression. I'm not quite sure I know what it means, but it's amazing nonetheless.
Yeah. And like any way I can visualize pulling a gourd from a horse is pretty funny.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, here in another couple scenes, she's going to be in half a scene, I guess. She's going to be giving him these valuable, precious swords.
So the same night, Nagakato, which is, again, Toranaga's son, and Ami, which is, again, Yabushigu's nephew, talk as young lords, equals, about their political predicament.
Yep. This is the goading scene, where Omi is whispering in his ear, trying to get him to make what he views as a mistake. And whether... this is tied up with anybody else. Here's the question I have is how much does Omi realize that Kiku was trying to influence him?
I don't think he realized. I think he's got a huge blind
spot. He thinks this is
spot.
All his idea.
Yeah, he thinks that she is a woman and makes his pee-pee feels good and feels like a man. And sure. How could she possibly outsmart someone? Yeah.
I think you're
right. And also, I think his desire for her overrides the obviousness of what's happening. Like, right. Well, like if he's willing to look and consider, but he doesn't want to because then he'd have to probably kill her. So,
sure. Yeah, it's super intricate and I find it compelling, especially when Toranaga's son takes the bait here. I just cannot wait for the next episode to see how this is perceived by Toranaga, I guess, when he gets word of it.
So you got another classic Toranaga rumble or
sure, probably at least one.
Cause that's the thing. It's like, I think Omi does such a good job of relating to him. It's like, oh man, we both have these family members that just can't see our true worth. And oh, your dad spits a bunch of bullshit wisdom at you. Wow. I can really relate to that. But Nagakato is scorning as like his dad being stuck in his ways, essentially Sun Tzu's The Art of War. Like, yes, this is conventional wisdom. Don't make the first move. Let, let the make mistakes capitalize on them. And he's like, I'm going to show my dad that I know what I'm doing by making a first move. That's probably a mistake that Ishido will capitalize on. So, but
I'm curious how Toranaga sees his moves, if he sees them as reactive or proactive.
And it's so effective, too, because Omi is constantly suggesting the right thing to do. Like, we should contact your father, see sure. what he yeah. has to say. And
But it's pride, right? This is pride fucking with you.
100%.
He is viewed as a soft kid. Mm-hmm. And if he goes and runs to his father here, that will perpetuate that view of him.
Yeah. I can't make a decision.
He's had enough.
Yeah.
Right. And so he goes and does this rash move, which is a huge mistake, probably. It's a great scene. It's a great series of scenes that they've done to influence kind of this next scene, or the one at the end, I guess.
Later in the evening, Blackthorn decides to take a little stroll, and Mariko decides to follow him. This allows her to explain some of her past, not enough for my taste, but some of it, and Blackthorn then tells her of his hometown of London.
Yeah. They take a Sanpo Osuru. I assume there's no innuendo there. I don't know. With the pillowing stuff, it's hard to tell.
As far as I can tell, no. That just means she's just trying to teach him the expression to take a walk, you know?
Okay.
Have a stroll. I thought, man, it's tantalizing the images we get. We see a little bit of her father, like with a little bit of a panicked look on his face, like he realizes something bad's about to happen. There's a brief scene of what I understand is Mariko as a young child or as a teenage girl fleeing in her fine clothes in a snowfield with like a warrior stalking behind. And she's gripping. It looks like someone puts a rosary in her hand and she's gripping onto it.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about long ago, a great injustice stole everything she had from her. And she's been waiting for an opportunity to essentially get revenge or to make restitution.
Yeah, some kind of resolution to that, which must be revenge. But against who? That's the big question, right?
And Toranaga, Big T, is the guy who has given her a path forward towards this. But we don't understand what any of this means.
Which is cool. I'm totally into the mystery of this.
I want to know because I'm impatient, and I want to know about what's obviously a deep and interesting story, but I respect the way that they're rolling this out.
And I really making that Eightfold Plan or Eightfold Fence personal here. The idea that, you know, the houses are destroyed and rebuilt 50 times. Same with this woman, you know?
Yeah.
And it doesn't diminish their houseness, you know? It doesn't diminish her as a woman. It's simply part of the history. And the good thing about the houses here is if the house does burn down with all these freaking candles, like paper walls with candles for lighting indoors is crazy to me, but you could just run right out the side of one of these houses, so no
true.
Big deal.
Like if it's on fire, you just dive out to any side and it burns out. Right. We'll make some more paper and we'll rebuild it tomorrow, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty effective.
And I also like the speaking of the Eightfold Fence, you can see Blackthorn understands that she's kind of retreating behind that because this is so painful for her to relate to a stranger. And he says, he gives that illustration of a house being destroyed and rebuilt 50 times. And he just sees the house. He doesn't see the ruin. And at that line, he says, "Here I see much woman, one that owes me, has no obligation to explain herself to me." And she kind of melts at that. And then...
Oh, yeah. I mean...
Go ahead.
Well, before we get to the next scene, because I think that's where we're headed. No.
I still want to talk about the conversation, but...
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, it seems like the English have a version of the Eightfold Fence themselves, and it's just a walk along the Thames, right? Where you sort of forget your troubles, forget yourself, and everything disappears and you're free.
Yeah. And he also just really turns on the engine riz. We'll meet the queen. We'll tour the palace. I'll go out for a dinner and I'll take you to a play and then we'll have a romantic walk along. And she's just literally eating it up. Like opening
she's
up
way
a whole
into this date night.
And I think the respect that he shows to her about not prying and not being this kind of brash, loud asshole that he's been up to now through the series is really intrigues him. Plus, also seeing him buck ass naked, Cosmo Jarvis,
I was gonna say.
A beautiful man, great body, handsome face, crazy eyes, but she's intrigued, you know.
Yeah. At least, okay. Let's talk about this next scene,
because later in the evening, Blackthorn is visited in his bedchambers by a courtesan who pillows with him. The next morning, he thanks Mariko for her and Fuji's thoughtful gift.
Watching this scene, and this scene is extraordinarily dark. It's hard to really see much of anything. I thought in this scene, this was Mariko coming to him.
Jim, I will bet 1,000 koku.
Okay, it's a lot of rice, man.
That is Mariko, in fact, and this
okay.
is
Gotta
this
be, right?
is all played as obvious Kabuku, like face saving. Yeah, I fucked you, but if anyone asks, no, I didn't. You know,
it was just some courtesan.
Like this is a weird situation. I'm a recent widow. You got a consort. You're a Japanese lord. Nah, we don't need anybody asking questions about what the ranks and the responsibilities. And we just kind of, I just want to pillow with you. You know.
Yeah.
Plausibly deniable pillowing.
Yeah. And they keep that plausible deniability with a lot of low light and bangs.
Yeah.
So you can't actually see who this is.
Yeah. But I did see some people in earnest arguing that it wasn't Mariko. And I think that's a wretchedly naive take. And again, if you want to bet me 1,000 koku, Shogun at baldmove.com. We'll see who's right in the weeks
to come.
At least
she caught him right after a bath. That's a pretty good time to pillow with this guy.
Yeah.
Like and the night of his annual bath.
One of the cultural holes I fell into was this Japanese practice that developed around this time and continued, I guess, in especially the rural villages up until the early 20th century, this practice of yobai, which means night crawling.
And, oh, I've seen this on Always Sunny. Uh huh. Nightcrawler, familiar.
No, I don't think it's there's no toe knives and
no
and worms involved. So this is it seems like every culture has this ability to say that their youth are chaste and upright and virginal, but also allow the fact that they're horny little goblins. I think of like in who was that guy? Mel Gibson's The Patriot. You remember like when Heath Ledger got sewn up in that sack, and then he was allowed to cuddle with his girlfriend, and the mom was the one that sewed him like in the sack up to his neck so they can cuddle but they can't fuck. But then there's also this kind of winking where the mom the dad says, I hope you did a better job of stitching than your mom did. And also the fact that you're bundling a boy with a woman who has been trained to sew since before she could probably she can't rip out a stitch and then whip it back up. Like, it's kind of,
yeah.
And so this yobai tradition, a young man who is sweet on a woman would dress up and disguise himself and sneak into her bedchambers and then essentially say, hey, I want to have sex with you. And if the woman is receptive, then they would have sex. And then he would escape in the dead of night. And the parents would either be genuinely ignorant or play ignorant because, you know, kids will be kids. And if the girl, if he's misread the girl and he rejects her, then he's disguised so he doesn't lose any face. He didn't, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think she's doing a little bit of night crawling here.
All right. Yeah. In the 80s, this was just climbing up the trellis through the window.
Sure.
That's what the night crawling was.
Your dad doesn't allow boys over, but he does have a suspiciously easy to climb trellis.
Right.
You love leaving your windows open. So.
And suspiciously secured to the house. I mean, my God, the bolts on this thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know if you need the something that's designed to have ivy climb, it needs to support an 18-year-old boy, but life finds a way is what we're trying to say here.
Sure does.
So Jozen, Ishido's man, attends the field practice, which Toranaga's son, Nagakato, is personally organizing and supervising. That's your first clue that fuckery is afoot. That today of all days, Yabushigo says, you know what, young man? You lead the field exercises.
The field, which is a second indicator of something is strange here.
And in a shocking move, he has the cannon turned on Jozen and his men, and they are butchered in what is likely the first overt act of war in the entire series.
Yeah, extremely gory. They show it in all its detail. Men are just exploding into showers of blood and chunks. The kind of stuff I like. I really enjoy seeing this.
I noticed that the director of this episode, Frederick Toye, has done a lot of work on The Boys. And it seems like maybe that experience paid off because these full body explosions are very The Boys. Very,
totally.
Very chunk. And it just does, man. And goddamn, Jozen seems like he's a big stick up his ass butthole. But he, like, man, he is in bad shape when Naga goes up there to finish him off. He's got like both his legs and one of his arms blown off and clearly mortally wounded and saying, this is not how samurai fight. Hate to break it, buddy. I think this is how samurai fight now.
Yeah. If they want to win, this is how they're going to have to fight. Is this chain shot, you think?
I suppose, because I was a little disappointed that they didn't get around to like, oh, here's chain shot. Tomorrow I'll show you how to use grape. And I imagine chain shot on infantry would be pretty horrific. Two cannonballs with about 3 foot of chain swinging like a bolo through, and that way they hit him with like 5-6 shots.
Yeah, boy, they have some serious trust in the accuracy of these cannons at this point, right? And their ability to set them up properly, because they're standing pretty close. I mean, when these things misfire,
but they have demonstrated that they have shown that these people know how to do it. So
is Blackthorn involved in this? Because I know he's been training them for a little while, but he's the pro, right?
I don't think so. I think he's just as shocked as anyone.
Yeah.
Now the question is, I got an answer. I got to answer what I think, but and obviously Ami is complicit because he's got this big grin on his face when he's the only one like smiling as all this is happening. But Yabushiga, to what extent? Do you think is it possible that Omni said, hey, uncle, I got a plan, leave it to me? Or do you think they hatched this together and Yabushiga's just playing dumb?
I think I think Omi might have taken this under his own initiative here. I don't even know that Yabushige... I think Yabushige thinks this is going to go off without a hitch. And when he's dumbfounded by Nagakato clearing the field and then, you know, the aftermath of that, I think that's genuine. Because I think he had a bit of a plan, right? Like, his plan was to reveal the cannon's strength and accuracy and to eliminate that element of surprise and win some favor with, Ishido? Yeah. But when he sees this, he's like, oh no, my plan has gone horribly wrong. I think this is all Omi.
That's the plain reading of the scene.
It's Omi, but through Kiku, through Ishido, right? Like,
Yeah. That's the puppet. This is one of those like puppeting, like chain, infinite chain of puppets that ends in Ishido.
Sure. Yeah.
And the only thing, and that's obviously the plain reading of the scene. The only thing that makes me think that Yabushige knew what was up is that I've never seen Yabushige behave this way. Like, I've never seen him do this performative, like, oh, consider what you're about, young lord. This is not... But also, he could be genuinely freaking the fuck out at what is happening.
Because his head is on the chopping block along with Toranaga's.
Yeah. And to your point, like, there's a scene of, like, where everyone's kind of holding their shocked expressions, and Omni is the only one who's got this, like, yes, yes, everything is going according to my plan.
Yeah, and this is definitely war. There's no way around that.
Yeah.
And I think Toranaga, so talk about like whether Toranaga is, you know, a mastermind of all this and expects it or whatever. I think whether he expects it or not, he always knew the war was coming. I mean, he's preparing for war. This might just accelerate the timeline a little to where he might not be quite as prepared as he wanted to be.
Yeah, I definitely think that. But on the other hand, I also wonder if he came up on this on his own. Oh, I guess this is smart. Because I was like, wouldn't Yabushige be furious? But like Omni could just be like, hey, man, I didn't have anything to do with this. I told the guy to tell his dad and, you know, play it cool and be 100% truthful about it. So it's like he is.
How does I know he'd get his pride all butthurt and go do something crazy?
Yeah, so Yabushige is getting Yabushige'd if we go with your interpretation of events, which I'm starting to warm up to.
That's how I read it.
Because it's not like I've seen Yabushige in these type of extreme circumstances before. Like, not this bad. Like, it's always been like a political thing, not like, oh God, someone just got killed. Do we have anything else to say about the episode, or should we get the feedback?
No, let's get into the feedback.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move. Yeah, let's talk about feedback. As we've invited several times this episode, shogun@baldmove.com is how you get in touch with us about this particular show. And also want to remind everybody that if you want to follow along with everything we're doing, check out our social media. Follow us at Bald Move everywhere. And finally, if you see fit to support us, if you enjoy the work we're doing here and on our other shows and you want to keep us going and get some stuff for yourself, ad-free feeds, bonus content. For example, we just had a premium podcast where we talked about Monarch, Godzilla King Kong show on Apple TV, Constellation also on Apple TV, and I talked about my experience with Avatar The Last Airbender, live action Netflix, all available to you at support.baldmove.com. Shogun@baldmove.com is what we're talking about right now, though, Jim. What do we got?
We got Kid up first, and... says Yabushige's pledge of fealty to Toranaga has constrained his options in all three episodes, and now four, it seems. Aaron rightly wondered why Yabu would stay hitched to the Toranaga wagon. Short answer is by oath. The longer answer is that Yabu's domain, which is Izu Province, is part of the Kanto region which Toranaga controls. I believe Toranaga was referred to as Lord of Kanto in episode 1. In the spectrum of wealth and power, the most powerful daimyos control entire regions. Provinces within those regions become vassal provinces, and their daimyos must bend the knee to the regional ruler.
Yeah, I get all that. My only question is why. I got the impression from Ishido that by his lights, Yabushige has kind of made this choice. Like, he's backed the wrong horse. And maybe like before he was given his lands, he had a choice about whether he wanted to fief them in Toranaga's or to fief them in Ishido's, or, and that's what, see, I, this is the other bone I had to pick with all these feudal political analysis, is everyone acts like the fucking laws are absolute, when obviously this thing told us from the second episode that nothing matters as long as you win.
Sure.
You know, you're not supposed to murder people that are under the guest right in Game of Thrones. That's the worst thing you could do in that world. Guess fucking what? It notably happened. You know, you're not supposed to, you're supposed to follow the laws of succession. This person had a son and you're supposed to, guess what? That gets thrown out the window all the time. So like, yes, you did recite how the power structure is supposed to happen, but we are dealing with a series where the power structure is being thrown out the window. So
when he's doing,
I
want
to know, why did Ishido, why did Ishido go to Yabushiga and essentially say, hey, well, I don't know why you backed the wrong horse, buddy. Apparently switching horses was a possibility for him. Maybe it's a possibility right now, and Yabushiga is just trying to, because of loyalty. That's the thing I'm still trying to understand, is why is he backing? Why is he continue to back? But it seems like a guy who's just trying to keep all of his options open to maybe his detriment.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the real thing, is this guy is, I mean, if he turns against Toranaga too early before Toranaga is sure to lose, Toranaga might take some revenge on him, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he has to kind of bide his time until the writing isn't just on the wall, but almost the deed is done. And if he can be the kind of straw that breaks that camel's back, then Ishido might be willing to give him a place in his fiefdom, I guess.
Joel says, listening to your coverage of episode 3, I want to point out one thing. Blackthorn isn't distracted by the fall of Toranaga's consort because he doesn't speak Japanese and doesn't understand what's been said. He instead keeps his eyes on Lady Kiri and sees the swap. It seems like we're saying the same thing.
I think the first thing was described more in the book, where he just wasn't really paying attention to that area because he doesn't understand Japanese, so he didn't really understand what was going on, and he happened to have his eyes over on Kiri.
Joel says, also, I forgot the name of Toranaga's consort, but it's not Lady Ochiba. Lady Ochiba is Taiko's widow and the mother of the heir, and is currently staying in Toranaga's castle in Ito. She was shown in episode 1 or 2 giving Toranaga the evil eye as she walked through the room. The Taiko touched on this because Ochiba wanted to marry Toranaga and he wasn't interested. Ah. Because she is Toranaga's castle, in Toranaga's castle, you can relatively assume that Lady Kiri and Toranaga's baby mama will be safe as political hostages.
Okay. Yeah, that makes some sense, why they wouldn't necessarily want to just murder his family here.
Yeah.
I
will confess, I have a hard time. It's been a challenge to get everyone's names and titles and everything and the relationships right with the main characters. Some of these tertiary, the older like ladies of the previous dynasty, I freely admit I'm getting them confused. I thought that was it Hiromato or the Iron Fist? I thought that was Lady Ochiba's his wife. And apparently, that wasn't even Lady Ochiba either. So. Is it Kiki? Is that the one that's Toranada's?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Consort.
Or so, Kiri. Is it Kiri?
I'd say it, and I can tell you. I keep the cast list open, but even then it's kind of hard because, like, you know, they're like first names, they're the last names, and a lot of them have the same last name because they're all related, but are they aunts and uncles or sons and daughters? Yeah.
Sure.
It's like I said, it's just a challenge. This is like, I wasn't this up on names in the first episode of Game of Thrones, let me tell you.
The first four episodes
of Game of Thrones. I was still saying, you know, the blonde sister fucker and, you know,
and a lot of
Ned
these people
sword
have been
guy
married.
And...
You're right. A lot of these people have been married to multiple other cast members, too, which makes it extra confusing. I thought she was the wife of him. Well, yeah, she was, but she's also the wife of this other guy. And then these guys have multiple wives. So, you know, I thought that was his wife. Nope, there are five of them or six of them.
And it's not his wife, it's his concubine. No, it's not a concubine, it's a consort. Ah, oh, fuck. It's like...
Right.
And they all have some kind of legal standing, I think. It's not like a concubine is just some hoe
side
over
piece,
there.
No.
Yeah.
All right, Chris writes in and says, just wanted to start by saying what an impressive job you guys are doing on tracking with all the intrigue and characters of this epic story. Somebody thinks we're doing it right. That's cool.
Thank you, Chris.
Lots to keep straight, and I'm thankful to have recently read the book, or I'd be drowning in the soup for sure. Or should I say, boiling in Yabu's torture cauldron.
Woof.
One clarification is, I'm confident you've already sorted out the Ochiba Shizu mix. No.
Boy, we were way off.
Shizu?
I think we got Kiku, the courtesans, fucked up our our mental math on this.
Okay, now I'm super confused. One clarification is, Mariko's only been married once to Buntaro. There was reference made earlier in the show of the loss of her father, which I think you may have mistaken for the loss of her husband.
I think you're 100% right there, Chris. Also,
man,
I've been looking forward to the show for a long time, so I kind of really kept up with the pre-show talk and, you know, her kind of tragic backstory and maybe, I think I got some things confused in my early show research that led me to make some wrong conclusions, but we're trying to get it right.
Yep.
RCM says, you guys have made some comments about how Toranaga views Blackthorn. It's actually pretty complicated. Toranaga, above all else, knows himself and knows what he needs to accomplish, his goals. He would sacrifice Blackthorn if need be, just like he'd probably sacrifice anyone. But the interesting thing is to know which pieces need to be sacrificed and when you need to sacrifice them. You have to know their true value. I know this might sound trite, but I think those are the values that make a top-tier strategist or chess player. Toranaga is patient, even caring, but also brutal when he needs to be. On another note, I love the actor playing Toranaga in The Last Samurai. I wasn't sure he'd match up to Toshiro Mifune or have the gravitas necessary for the role. However, he's doing a great job. The guy playing Blackthorn, on the other hand, I violently disagree. I thought Cosmo was going to be the weak point, and I am consistently impressed at how broad and barbarian he can be, and also how kind of quiet and gentle and listening he can be. I'm loving him as the lead.
Yeah, I don't think there's a weak point in this series. I've not seen anybody who hasn't brought exactly what they needed to bring in any given scene.
Yeah, and I've seen Hiroyoku Sanada in enough stuff that I knew he could, he's going to crush this role. Like, I mean, yeah, he's essentially the Last Samurai guy with another 20 years of experience on him. So I fully expected him to just nail it. And he's also been a big champion of the show. Like, about a month before the show came out, I started seeing, like, little shorts on YouTube and TikTok where he was talking about his role as a producer and how much of a leadership role he kind of took and sweating the historicity and, you know, making sure all the costuming and the weaponry was right. And what an extra burden of work it is, like being, you know, he's used to just being an actor and showing up. And now it's like he did all this work and then it's like, oh, shit, I also have to star in the show. he seems like a really interesting, thoughtful guy. And you see all those layers.
I mean, I can understand why you'd be nervous about it. I mean, Mifune, he's in several of the Kurosawa movies.
That's Kurosawa's guy. Like, that's, you know, like, that's Robert De Niro to Martin Scorsese. Like, he starred in so many of his movies.
Yeah. And he's an incredible actor. So I can understand, like, can anybody measure up to that guy? And it turns out, he's doing a great job.
And a living legend when he played. I don't know that Sonata's at that level yet. But right. Yeah.
I mean, stuff like this, it'll get him there, I think.
Oh, for sure.
All right, let's go over to Nate, who says, just joined the Discord, really solid, lots of fun. They said I should still send in my thoughts, so here you go. Yeah, that's something to point out. If you guys want to talk about this sort of between episodes here, we have channels over in our Discord, which is just at discord.baldmove.com. If you're a Discord user, you know how to check that out. It's not too complicated, though it can be a little cumbersome when you first sign up if you're not familiar with Discord. But yeah, if you want to get involved in the conversation, we've got that over there for you.
Yeah.
Nate has some quick highlights. He says, number one, I lost it at I don't want any generous cuckoos. that was a great line. If you don't know, a koku... not a cuckoo, a koku, is a unit of measure for rice yield. You'll see various definitions, most commonly something like the amount of rice it takes to feed a man or family for a year. It varied a bit over time, but the bottom line is it's a lot of rice. And this is how they measured a samurai's income or salary.
That's a lot of rice. Yeah. And I guess that's I forgot to mention that, but yeah, it's that's essentially your status. Like, how many men at arms can you support on your salary? Yeah. That's directly proportional to your power, which also makes sense of why they, you know, we talked about in the first two episodes that they kind of stratify the samurai class by that salary. It's just strictly from highest to lowest.
And it's also kind of a means of control of power, right?
Sure.
I mean, giving someone the ability to feed a larger army directly gives them more power.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not literally, that's the other thing to understand, it's not literally rice. Sure. Like, it's, if your province doesn't make rice, but you make, I don't know, ginger and fine swords, and there was an exchange, an equivalency rate for like so many bushels of rice equals so many of this other thing. So this is all converted.
I wonder when that happened, though, because there's a reason it's called koku, and it's probably because it started as literal rice given to you.
Probably.
By your lord.
I imagine about time to start forging steel. That's when it's like, sure. What the fuck? I'm making 1,000 swords, and then but I don't make rice, so I starve. Fuck you, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Number two, the pillowing, etc. phrasing for sex really bothered me because in the book, Clavell uses all kinds of inane metaphors for sex to make it sound exotic. When it occurred first in episode 2 and then episode 4, I was worried where they'd go with this. Really? They're going to keep that nonsense? But if you watch the scenes and John Blackthorne's reactions, it's subtly making fun of the whole thing. In episode 4, when he's talking about not wanting to pillow her or pillow on her or next to her, I think it's a nod of how silly the whole exoticized metaphors are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see that, but that's a good point.
I think that's like the essential, that's one of the essential kind of charges of Orientalism at Clavell's work, is that he does seem to kind of revel in the erotic mysteries of Japan, you know, and the fact that they're so enamored of Blackthorne's enormous English dong. And
yeah,
I'm kind of like, because I see some people bemoan that some of that's like, oh, it's not this series is not nearly as funny as the book. And I'm like, this series is pretty fucking funny. And if the thing that's cut out is like dick jokes or like he doesn't want to fuck a man or a woman, put a duck in his room because he might want to fuck a duck. I can go without that. I'm fine with
okay,
that being
I
out.
Didn't know about the duck thing, but
yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a hornpipe scene that sounds kind of interesting and funny in the book that got omitted, but. Yeah, again, I'm surprised at how
the
funny
description of the penis scene was. Pretty funny. I would have liked that, but I'm a child, so
yeah. You just want your English dong flattered, or right, your Italian even worse. My God,
yeah, I have no horse in the English dong race, man.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on.
Number three, the literal only problem with all of the cannon firing scenes was that it reminded me they shot all of this in British Columbia, because that does not look like Japan at all, except maybe remote parts of Hokkaido. I wouldn't know.
Oh, yeah.
The good thing about watching this and this being all foreign to me is I wouldn't know. I do know that this is the most common thing in the world when it comes to making movies or television. You film where it's cheapest. And then and if it's cheaper to make Ontario or Southern California look like Japan, they're going to do it that way. If it's cheaper to go there, they'll do it that way.
And I got to say, like, I think it's doing a pretty good job of where they're shooting this to kind of aping Japan, but it's not going to be perfect, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I know a lot of people couldn't tell the difference between Northern California and Eastern Kentucky when they're making Justified, but like, fuck, yeah. No, I mean, yeah, that is like very obvious to me as a Midwesterner that we're not in this part.
Yeah.
But yeah, you got to do what you can do to work within the budget you got, right?
Totally. Number four, how are they going to make the changes to fix Clavell's travesty of English man comes and teaches noble savages how to use a modern gun technology was one of my biggest concerns, and they knocked it out of the park. Podcast has a historian that they consulted on the show, and he describes telling the writers, not no, but for fuck's sake, no, you're not doing it this way. They had guns for almost 60 years. Yeah, he's glad they fixed that. And he really liked the line, that was a very thoughtful gift from who we presume is Mariko. To
again, they got 1,000 kokus on the line.
Yeah.
I got 1,000 generous cuckoos for anybody who wants to claim them. If you could prove that wasn't Mariko.
And finally, number six here, in regards to Josen's last words, as he's laying there with a stump for an arm about to be hacked to death, he says, "This is not how samurai fight, you're savages, all of you." The knee-jerk reaction for most viewers would be to see this as commentary on Bushido and proper ways for honorable samurai to fight and all such other nonsense. Please put that aside because it's garbage. It's not any less how samurai fight than murdering the shogun in the middle of a no play, which I take it as a very specific reference that I don't know. It is, however, an extremely sudden and brutal action. I think we shouldn't overread into it about properness and simply take it as a comment on, holy crap, I just had my legs blown off and all my men are in literal pieces around me. That's savage. It's also war. Yes.
I want to disagree in part with Nate here because I do. Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably ahistorical and also what is seen as butchery and savagery in one culture is seen as noble act of war in another. But narratively, if we leave the historicity aside, narratively, I think they're trying to say that just as Blackthorn is being kind of Japanified by his experience with Japanese, that he's also injecting a little bit of barbarism that doesn't come naturally to their culture to inside it.
Yeah, so, I agree. Again, the narrative is saying that.
Yeah, and it does. Like I said, this is a historical drama, which means it doesn't have to be true, and you can lean into some themes that are pleasing from a storytelling perspective. And it's always nice to have people who are steeped in history show us where that's wrong. But like, I do think that's intentional. Like, this is the crossroads of the season. This is the literal midpoint in the season. Blackthorn is starting to become more like the Japanese and admiring them, and he's also the barbarian. I don't think that was accidental.
No, it's not. And I also think there are various strata of propriety in that society, right? Yeah. I mean, when Toranaga befuddles the council by saying, "Ha, I resign, and now you only have 4 and you can't actually vote on anything," they're sort of bound by those constraints because of who they are and the importance that people put in them and the importance of those, even if they're facades, those rules on society.
Right.
Whereas you can't tell me that there were not atrocities committed by supposedly honorable samurai all across the country at all different times.
This play from 1441 is an instance of that kind of butchery. Because agree in part with Nate. Clearly, Josen here is coping hard. You totally, just kicked our shit in, and it's not fair, you know? That happens. Yeah. You know, when absolutely, the first guy war, invented the machine gun, it was not fair to the other side, but...
Nope. I mean, we're 300 years after this going to drop a bomb that is not fair to the Japanese, but...
This is true.
It's war, man.
Japanese did a lot of things were not fair to mainland China.
Yep.
One side was held account, one was not. Probably has to do with who won and who lost, but... Oh, a neighbor, Cincinnati Joe, says, "Great show, though I do have some questions/nitpicks. I don't remember if this came up in your discussion of the last episode, but how would Mariko be able to translate Blackthorn's logbook? He's an Englishman piloting a Dutch ship, so he's not going to record things in Portuguese, the language of his enemies, which is what he used to speak to Mariko. No one in Japan knows English or Dutch." Because I was curious about this, too.
There's an actual answer for this? Because it seems like a huge flaw.
When you see Mariko kind of shuffling between the papers, it appears that she's shuffling between a like Latin to Portuguese because she knows both. And then she's also got a crib sheet of Latin to English. And I think she's converting the rudder to Latin. And then she has essentially a dictionary or a crude.
Where did she get that?
I have no fucking clue. But I don't also think it would be impossible for her to get.
Portuguese are just bringing that over. They don't want them to know about the English at all.
Yeah. I'm just telling you what they're, because I think, and there might, the answer might be there's no real answer, but I think that's what they're suggesting, is that she has got some kind of Rosetta Stone. Like, she knows Portuguese, she knows Latin, and she has a key that can explain. She doesn't have something that says English to Portuguese, but she does have Portuguese to Latin handled, and she's found the Latin to English guidebook, and she's using that to translate it.
I think they should have made that more explicit. That should have been part of a narrative at some point where she gets an English to Latin,
honestly, I didn't even
English
like
translation
through two close watches, and I'm clearly obsessed with the show, paying clear attention. I didn't even get like that's a problem until I saw people discussing it.
Fair.
So
yeah, neither did I until this email came in. So thanks for that, Joe. Finally, Skid Rhodes, which I like the name. it's Rhodes like Randy Rhodes. He says, I read Shogun twice. It's a terrific novel. I have some strong opinions on characters, but they would lead to spoilage, so I'll have to save it for the wrap-up episode. I will mention Kasegi Yabu, who's Yabushige in the show, boil people alive regularly. The men he had in charge of the fire would make sure to regulate the heat so as to draw out the process as long as possible. Not really a spoiler since we're past that, but a reason I did a double take when you both mentioned how much you liked him. Look, like I said before, I can enjoy watching somebody on screen and think they're a reprehensible person that I would never want to be real.
I really loved the Hound on Game of Thrones, even before he had his face turned. I thought Roose Bolton was kind of cool, even though he's obviously a bastard.
I really enjoyed Ramsay.
I thought Littlefinger was a hell of a fun time to watch too. Like, yeah, we're allowed to think that reprehensible people are kind of Darth Vader.
Yeah.
Notoriously cool. So yeah,
I like Ramsay because he never has the face turn, right? Yeah. Ramsay's my example of like entertaining to watch, never becomes a good guy.
Yeah, how can you not like him wiggling that sausage when he's
it's
tormenting?
It's so entertaining.
Dion. Yeah, but I mean, it is horrific. Every time I see a scene of this, like that's the stuff I've warmed up to horror, but I don't like torture porn because it really does bother me on a deep level to know what man is capable of doing to man. And like, it's very hard for me not to identify with the victim and like what a fucking dehumanizing experience that is on top of just the physical component. Just like what's going through your mind when this shit's happening. Yeah, I don't like to dwell on it because it takes me to dark places. But Yabushige seems like a hell of a guy when he's not boiling people alive.
Skid continues. The other reason I emailed was to give some James Clavell recommendations. He wrote a sequel to Shogun called Gaijin. There's a substantial time jump, so there are no further adventures of the characters you come to know and love from the first book.
And I know enough Japanese to know that that literally means foreigner.
Yeah. Which, it's not about Blackthorn, apparently, so another foreigner. He also wrote a two-novel story about the British in Hong Kong. Taipan is set in 1840 something and tells the story of British traders establishing themselves in Hong Kong. It's a great adventure with adventure read with plenty of boats for Aaron.
And then I do love my boats.
The sequel to that is
they're actually ships. Boats are what's carried on ships.
Yeah,
a ship is not a boat.
Yeah, the boats transport you to the ship.
Unless it's a submarine. For some reason, they're boats. I don't know why. Doesn't make sense, but their boats.
All right. And then the sequel to that is set in the 1960s and follows the surviving trading companies from the first novel. It's called Noble House. Both excellent reads, though they are clearly told through the romanticized lens of a Westerner, just like Shogun.
So here's the thing, and this is what's very exciting to me. I'm reading between the lines of production company and crew, and I think there's a possibility if Shogun does really well that they will probably adapt all of these as independent miniseries. Because why the fuck wouldn't they?
Yeah, I could at the very least get down with the sequel to Shogun.
I'm telling you, every 2 or 3 years if they trot one of these out and they're as good as Shogun, I am going to devour them.
Yeah.
Like a hungry samurai chows through a koku over the course of a year.
God, that guy just ate 3 koku worth. Holy shit.
Holy shit, the guy ate 330 pounds of rice. You fetch the doctor. That's I'm gonna overdose on this stuff. And yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, man, I'm gonna wait a couple years to read the other books because I'm kind of hoping that they adapt them. And I'm just having so much fun going through this with virgin eyes. And I'm like cannot wait till the show's over so I can read the novel. Oh, so excited! I'm always get so excited when I get introduced to stuff and I find out there's even more stuff.
Oh man. Yeah,
the best. Anyway, that's our show. Shogun@baldmove.com if you'd like to get in touch with us and tell us about your experiences with the show or our coverage of same. Also at baldmove everywhere if you'd like to follow us on social media. And finally, support.baldmove.com if you want to support what we're doing here and to help us keep podcasting. We'd appreciate it. That's going to be it. We'll be back for the fifth episode next week. Can't wait. Hope to see you there. Until then, my name's Aaron.
I'm Jim.
See ya.